Good afternoon. I'm opening the Senate Committee on Consumer Protection and Public Affairs for today, Thursday, April 23rd. I'm going to start with Senate Bill 515. I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 515. We do have an amendment that is fairly new. And Lori, do you want to tell us, please, about the Dash 8 amendment?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Madam Chair and members of the committee, Senate Bill 515 has been before you several times, focuses on what is commonly known as lemon laws. The Dash 8s, dated 4/22/09, you should have before you, and they simply deal with some provisions about the motorhome clarification of the motorhome provisions. So let me read from the staff measure summary. This Dash 8 creates new reasonable amounts for use calculation for motorhomes particularly. It allows 60 or more cumulative days rather than the 30 or more cumulative days applied to motor vehicles when determining nonconformity due to the motorhome being out of service because of repair or correction. There are some other minor technical changes as well.
Thank you. And I'm going to ask Emily Kinzer to come up and explain the Dash 8 amendments. And if anyone has any questions, Emily has been involved in this bill from the very beginning, and she'll be able to answer your questions for you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Emily Kinzer, Legislative Assistant to Suzanne Bonamici. Wanted to explain a little bit about the Dash 8 amendments. We are still planning to adopt the Model RV law, but it's taking longer and is a little bit stickier than is conducive to our deadlines. So while we work with legislative counsel and with the industry, we wanted to get into the main text of the bill some stipulations that were best for consumers and for the industry alike. So the Dash 8 amendments do the following. They define motorhome for the purposes of the lemon law. They provide that the denominator for calculating reasonable allowance for use for motorhomes is 90,000, and they allow for a motorhome to be out of service for 60 calendar days rather than the 30 stipulated for a regular automobile before it is considered a lemon. So these changes have been vetted with the RV industry and meet with their approval, so much so that I am sort of here as their advocate today. So I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you, Emily.
Thank you very much.
So I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 515. And committee, I would like to entertain a motion to adopt the Dash 8 amendments to Senate Bill 515. I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 515. We do not have the fiscal paperwork that we need to move this bill forward, however.
Dash 8s?
Mm-hmm. I would like to adopt the Dash 8s.
Yes. Madam Chair, I move the Dash 8 amendments to Senate Bill 515.
Dated April
22nd.
There we go.
Thank you. Senator George moves that we adopt the Dash 8 amendments to Senate Bill 515. Any discussion? Any objection? Would you like a roll call vote, Senator John?
Oh, I love a roll call vote.
Okay. Can we have a roll call vote on the Dash 8 amendments, please?
Oh, not on the amendments.
No. Oh, not on the amendments?
No,
oh, okay. I just want to make sure that we're meeting your needs. Roll call vote. Okay. Seeing no objection, the Dash 8 amendments to Senate Bill 515 are adopted, and I'm going to carry this over. I believe it's posted on Tuesday for work session. So now I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 515, and we will see this on Tuesday. And next on our agenda is Senate Bill 628. I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 628. I don't know if anyone's here to testify. I'll have Ann check that. No? Okay. Anyone here to testify on Senate Bill 628? I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 628. I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 628 and let the committee know that we are also unable to do anything with this bill today because we don't have the fiscal information required to take action on this. So I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 628.
What a hammer.
And
forceful today.
I have this in my hand, your committee. I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 731. Lori, can you please give us an update on where we are on 731?
I can, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, Senate Bill 731 has been before you. In fact, it was before you just on Tuesday. This deals with issues of garnishment and exempt exempt funds and the garnishment of those funds. The Dash 8 amendments were simply were introduced and spoken to on Tuesday. Let me just summarize those briefly. The Dash 8s protect the amount in the account equal to the amount of the certain direct exempt funds in the calendar month preceding the receipt of the garnishment. It also specifies that the protection applies when the financial institution can readily identify qualifying exempt funds or when the account holder formally identifies those qualifying exempt funds. It increases the garnishment search fee paid to financial institutions from $10 to $15. It exempts the Department of Revenue from the search fee increase. It removes a wild card exemption increase, and it adds a good faith exemption from potential financial institution liability when the institution is determining whether funds are subject to garnishment.
Thank you so much. And is anyone signed up for testimony on Senate Bill 731? And I would.
There was no form.
I'm happy to right now ask if anyone is here to come forward on Senate Bill 731. And while you're coming forward, I want to take just a minute to introduce our committee administrator's daughter, Sky, who's helping us out today. She's here visiting the Capitol. She goes to Cleveland High School in Portland, and she's 16 years old. She's a sophomore, and she studies Spanish and Chinese and plays lacrosse. So welcome her to the committee today.
Madam Chair, member of the committee, Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association. We have obviously, at the Chair's request, been very involved in this bill, worked with Senator Girard and others to try to come up with some language. And in general, I believe we're headed in the right direction. I'm not here today to oppose the bill, but one of the issues that we've worked a lot of, spent a lot of time on is this issue of the form. And I have heard and talked to many of my members, talked to in-house counsels with banks as well as the OBA Council, and we finally come to the conclusion that for our perspective, the form makes no sense. And I'll tell you why. Our goal in promoting this form was that when you came in and opened up an account with us, we would have this form for you to sign, and you would either say, I don't have any of these payments made to me, or these are the ones I do have. And I will let you know when that situation changes, so that the burden would be on the customer, not on the financial institution. So that down the road, if a garnishment was served at the bank, they could look online, look at their screen, their home screen, and see, yes, this person has filled out a form, and he does not, or he or she does not have any of these payments. And at that point, our job would be complete. It's my understanding that the proponents, after we see that there's no form, after we see there is a form on file and none of these payments are being made into this account, that we do take that next step and see if any are readily identifiable under that list. To us, that makes the form really useless because we can't count on it, we can't depend on it. We not only have to use the form, but then secondly turn around and check the account in greater detail. I've talked to the proponents of the bill several times about that. I do not believe they're willing to put that burden on the consumer. And if that's the case, we would simply look to take that form out of the bill. And I'm not asking that to happen over here on the Senate. We would certainly try to accomplish that over in the House. We're not here to slow down the bill.
Thank you.
Pam? Madam Chair and members of the committee, Pam Levitt with Credit Union Association of Oregon. I did testify on this issue two meetings ago on Senate Bill 731-8, but I do want to just make it clear also that we have a problem with a different part of the amendments. In Section 2, Sub 3A, I've talked to most of you about our concerns about the readily identified language, and we would propose to change that to say payments identified in information transmitted with the payments as being one of the types of payments described in Section 2. What we're trying to do with that language change is basically say that the payments coming in have to be identified to us as exempt funds. And some of the examples that our members members gave me on a conference call was an exempt, or a fund might come in and it might say State Farm. Well, there's State Farm annuity accounts and there's State Farm workers' compensation accounts. One is exempt and one is not. And that is our issue of having the funds being identified to us when they come in. And we're having the financial institution readily identify. We think that there is some legal problems with that language. Another example that they gave me is Boeing. Boeing can come in as Boeing or it can come in as Boeing employees in a pension trust. One is a retirement account that's exempt and one is funds that are not. So we're just trying to make the bill better. We certainly do not, as Tim mentioned, we don't want to slow down the bill and we support working on this on the House side, but we just want to make a point that our members still tell me that this is a problem for them and they foresee some legal problems down the road with having that language readily identify. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. And I think Sybil Hebb will come up and make a few points about it. Appreciate your bringing those issues to our attention. And I do want to point out that there is, Pam, you've had that same concern, that there is the exemption from liability for good faith. So that was sort of the balance there that we strove to make.
Madam
sure.
Chair, I talked to our attorneys about that, and they said I can still foresee someone bringing some challenges to it, even with the good faith in there.
So I think that may be true no matter what we do with this business.
Our goal is to make this as strong a language, a good bill, so we don't have to come back next session. And
appreciate that.
Thank you
so much. Sybil?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center here today in support of the Dash 8 amendments to Senate Bill 731. Very much appreciate the work that's gone into this proposal and specifically the leadership of Senator Girard and of the Chair and the support of the committee in hearing about this issue over the session. I guess I'll speak to sort of two perspectives, and I think the banks have expressed a concern about whether or not the form that's contemplated by the Dash 8 amendments and has been contemplated throughout the amendments to the bill is useful to the banks. And I would submit that it is useful in that it helps to identify forms that are there. So the proposal, the way that it is structured now, is that an account holder can fill out a form to indicate whether they are receiving funds, if they are receiving funds. If there is a form that says that they are, that helps the account, the institution to say, oh, there are the forms and I can see them easily. If there is not a form, the funds are readily identifiable in the by the institution, then there's no reason for the protection not to continue to apply. These are vulnerable people whose exempt benefits we're trying to protect. Many times they're the elderly, people with disabilities, both cognitive or physical, and the burden on them, requiring a burden on them to get to the bank and fill out a form to even know that requirement might apply, we feel is too great and would not in the end accomplish the protection that is the goal of the bill. We believe that the burden on the institutions by the Dash 8 amendments is really very minimal. Are the funds identifiable? Are they readily identifiable? That's a very generous standard, and it's much more generous than the other states that have taken these steps. And so if the bank can readily identify, and I think you have some records in your documents that show clearly labeled veterans benefits or Social Security benefits, then that's the kind of thing that can be readily identified and ought to be protected under the bill, regardless of whether there's a form on file. And again, as has been pointed out, there is a complete release of liability for the institution if they happen to make the wrong call. And so I think that there's not a very great likelihood that would lead to lawsuits because there's such a complete release of liability. The only other thing I would add is that the proposal that the funds be identified as exempt by the sender is something that I'm not sure that we could accomplish in Oregon law, because that would be a requirement that would have to apply to a federal institution which issues, for example, the Veterans Administration or the Social Security Administration issues many millions of checks. And to do something specific for a particular state would be impractical, but also I think we don't have the authority to tell them how to handle their documents. And so I think I'll close by just saying that I think that making sure that this protection is practically available and accessible to the vulnerable people that we're trying to protect is a key goal, and we think the Dash 8s accomplish that in a reasonable way that isn't burdensome for the accounts, for the institutions, and I very much appreciate your attention. Happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Anyone else here would like to say anything about 731? I'm going to close the public hearing on 731 and open a work session on Senate Bill 731.
Madam Chair, I move the Dash 8 amendments to Senate Bill 731. Sorry.
Oh,
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Do you want to do it in unison?
No, let him go.
Okay. Well, one of you please make the motion.
I yield to the Vice Chair.
Madam Chair, I move the Dash 8 amendments to Senate Bill 731, dated April 21st.
Senator George moves that we adopt the Dash 8 amendments to Senate Bill 731. Is there any discussion?
Madam Chair? Yes. Just briefly, I just want to acknowledge that the credit unions do still have concerns about the language, but I hope that I do support the bill, but I hope as it moves forward on the House side, perhaps those can still be worked on a little bit further.
I appreciate that. Thank you, Senator Rosenbaum, and I'm committed to working on that. Thank you very much. Any objection? Without objection, the Dash 8 amendments are adopted.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 731 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator George moves Senate Bill 731 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Ann, can we please have a roll call?
Senator Burden?
Aye.
Senator Girard?
Aye.
Senator Rosenbaum?
Aye.
Vice Chair George?
Aye.
Chair Bonamici?
Aye. Senate Bill 731 goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and the chair will carry the bill. And I will, oh, and I forgot to mention that you do have at the dais a minimal impact expenditure and no revenue. So you've had that at your place. So I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 731, and I'm next going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 811. And Lori, can you please tell us where we are on Senate Bill 811?
I would be happy to, Madam Chair and members of the committee. You have before you the most recent amendments. They are Senate Bill 811-2s. Dated April 22nd, 09, and these essentially replace the measure, so I will summarize those briefly. The Dash 2 amendments allow for 4 months of assessments to be prioritized before a first mortgage, a land sale contract in first position, or a first trust deed. It applies those provisions to condominiums with 7 or more units with certain exceptions. It revises notice and recordation provisions. It clarifies assessments subject to priority lien of association, and it allows the Association Board of Directors to enforce the assessment collection by lien foreclosure and action to recover a money judgment or by accepting the deed in lieu of foreclosure.
Thank you very much. Did you get all that, Sky? Senator Walker?
Yeah, may I bring up Ms. Gustafson with me?
Please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Vicki Walker, State Senator, District 7. I have with me Ms. Gustafson, who is here to testify on the Dash 2 amendment. Ms. Gustafson came to see me a couple of weeks ago about this bill because we've worked on condominium association bills before, and I will just state right up front, even though I'm not voting today, hopefully we will have a chance to vote on this. I will declare a potential conflict of interest. I will actually declare an actual conflict of interest because I am a homeowner of a condominium, and I am on the board of the Homeowners Association. So the reason Ms. Gustafson came to see me is because I would have a high interest in this bill, and I do. And that is why I'm here today to discuss it with you. I looked at the original bill and understand, and I've read over Mr. Martinez's testimony from the last hearing, and Ms. Gustafson and I have spoken, and she has sent sense, narrowed the bill down. I would say watered the bill down, but we'll say narrowed the bill down to be something very small, but very much needed right now in this high period of foreclosure. I read somewhere the other day that Oregon was 24th in the nation for foreclosures about a year or so ago, and now we are 5th in the nation. So this is a problem stretching all across Oregon. I can tell you as a homeowner of a condominium, and while it is my vacation home, we did use the investment from my father-in-law's passing to invest in this, and this is really part of our retirement income when I ever do get a chance to retire. But I can tell you that as a homeowner, I am fearful that some of our fellow homeowners are going to not be able to continue afford their payments, and they can go into default. We have been very, very careful about this as a board because I'm not interested in paying someone else's fees or dues. And we've been extremely careful to hold our homeowners to the fire. If they are even the least bit late, we start up with the phone calls and the collection activity. And we have been very lucky, though. One homeowner was close to bankruptcy, and they avoided that. But we also have situations where we have special assessments. And so it's not just your regular monthly dues for common area expenses. It's also these special assessments, like we had to put on a new roof a couple of years ago when the rain started, and it started pouring into my unit and others. And that was a pretty hefty special assessment. So if you have homeowners that go into foreclosure, then that all has to be shared with the remaining homeowners. I understand the lending institutions are a bit nervous about this because they don't like someone else being in first position because they like to be in first position themselves. But I don't think it's in the best interest of our state to have homeowners having to pick up the slack, and other homeowners are just struggling to stay alive as well. So I'm not interested in seeing this go into an interim committee for further study. I think action is really important now, and that's why Ms. Gustafson has narrowed the bill very, very much so that it only affects condos, and we can take care of this problem immediately and then have further discussion about some of the larger, broader issues that she had in her bill. It will be necessary, I believe, to take care of Oregonians in this way, and we've reduced the 6 months of homeowners' dues down to 4 that would be available for lien in first position by the Homeowners Association. So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I do think this is important. Ms. Gustafson perhaps had testified previously on this bill about the high number of foreclosures we had. If she hasn't, I'm sure she has those figures, but I'm here today to be in support of these Dash 2 amendments. If you have any questions.
Thank you, Senator Walker. Any questions for Senator Walker? I don't know if you're planning to stay.
I actually need to get back to committee because yesterday I was gone for 4 bills that were up all within the same hour.
Questions for Senator Walker? Senator Gerard.
Madam Chair, are you answering any questions about wolves?
this morning, and we have had no wolves in our condo, though we have had a dead cow on the beach. We have had a dead sea lion. We've had a number of things that needed to be dealt with, but no wolf in sight.
A federally protected sea lion?
Is that what I just heard?
Maybe, Madam Chair.
I'm, sure I heard that
I'm afraid I'm going to need to restore order pretty soon here. For those of you who missed it, we had Animal Day before this morning.
I thought it was pretty strange to see a Jersey cow on our beach. Our beach is in Nesquin, and it was very strange to be walking along. My husband thought it was a whale, and I said, no, a whale doesn't have spots like that. And we got closer, and it was a cow. And I can only assume it came down from one of the Tillamook dairy farms during one of the floods. So we do see strange things from time to time, but we also see some of the most beautiful oceanfront and wildlife in Oregon. So it is very lovely.
Are there any questions about Senate Bill 811 for Senator Walker? Thank you, Senator.
All right, thank you.
Ms.
Gustafson? Thank you, Senator Walker, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. I'm Karna Gustafson, and I'm here to testify in favor of the Dash 2 amendments. As Senator Walker mentioned in her testimony, we have removed all references to the Planned Community Act, which is what Mr. Martinez had testified against in the previous hearing. He thought that these provisions should not apply to planned communities. I had a client ready to testify on the planned community portion, but since we had agreed to reduce that and take that out, I'd be more than happy to talk to Tim Martinez and Jim Marquis and their clients about the Planned Community Act portion, but we have removed it from the bill, and we have reduced the amounts from 6 months down to 4 months. We believe it's extremely important for the homeowners associations and the owners in these condominiums to have some sort of protection in the facing the foreclosures that we've seen that have increased astronomically. So I would like to ask for your support for the dash two amendments. Any questions?
Thank you. Any questions?
Sure. Thank you. Senator Walker brought up an interesting issue. I just got the dash twos and so I'm reviewing them, but when you get a special assessment for like a roof or a major remodel of some sort, those can be fairly large. Are those also included in the dash two amendments? Like if it's 4 months, if it happens within the 4 months during the foreclosure, would that special assessment also, or is it just the monthly maintenance fee?
It's any assessment. Most assessments, even for roofs, aren't done in a one-time, you know, $4,000 amount. They are done over time, so you'll see the monthly assessment be $150, and then you'll see an additional $50 for a roof assessment. That's typically how the associations that we represent do it. We represent about 1,200 associations like this, but they'll do it over time because the owners can't afford the one time. Having said that, I'm sure that there are associations out there that do that, but it's fairly uncommon because they can't afford it. And fines, by the way, are not included, but I testified to that before.
Okay. Any other questions?
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Rich File, please. Welcome.
Well, thank you. Rich File, File Fotheringham. I testified earlier on this bill as well. Our law firm, like Karna's, has a large number of homeowners associations. We represent about 2,000 associations with significant problems that would be addressed by this bill. I want to ask for your forgiveness for not having gone out and done my work in terms of getting some kind of compromise on this bill earlier. I did not understand that was the task, and I apologize. Unfortunately, the compromise that I think we've reached does confuse things in some ways that are difficult, but definitely improves the situation for homeowners associations. And so even though we're looking at a glass half full, I want to voice my support for this committee to pass this and send it on to the House.
Any questions? Mr. Brown?
Thank you very
much.
You. I have a Georgette Brown, please.
Chair Bonamici and members of the committee, I am Georgette Brown, and I represent the Oregon County Clerks Association. I'm a retired county clerk. We don't have any position on the bill itself. We're neutral as far as the bill itself. We just have a technicality in the recording part of it. So that's what I wanted to bring to your attention. But it was in the dash one, and all I'm hearing today is the dash two. So is the dash one
still? Do you have the
dash two? I have the dash two, but this has not is dash two is in a different section than the dash one recording part that I'm talking about.
Connie, do you want to come back up?
Hi.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I talked to Harrison at Legislative Council about this, and he and I discussed in detail about the difference between what the county clerks were concerned about, and he's had discussions, I don't know about recently, with them, but to help fix what it is that the communication is.
Okay.
About it. But he's completely aware of the issue.
All right. Because it's mentioning deed records, and then it's mentioning being recorded in the liens as the in the lien records of the county clerks, and so it's intermixing deed records and lien records, and it needs to be in the lien records because anybody looking for a lien looks in the lien records, and that's what it was in the dash one, but evidently it's being fixed.
Harrison mentioned that he's completely aware of the issue. And has talked to somebody about it.
Thank you. And was it resolved in the dash two amendment?
My understanding is he believes it was, but you know, I don't know that much about the issue, and I apologize.
I have the dash two here.
Page three,
about recording.
Page four,
the
page
original
three,
lines
this.
12 and 13. It was on page 3, line 25 through 28, was the original language. The new language just cleans it up. It doesn't change it, according to Harrison from Legislative Council. I'm trying to figure out where the new language went to.
Very good.
Is that
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, and Karna, would you look on page 3 and check line 12 and 13? Is that Harrison talked to me yesterday, and I gave him the email that was sent to the committee.
Right, this got taken out. So the only two left are this taken out, and then this got put in.
Okay, so as long as there's no reference to the
there is not.
No.
Okay.
I think that took care of the problem.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, what Harrison did was generalize it so that it now says, as other liens are recorded and indexed, rather than mixing it between deed records.
Fine.
And
thank you. I'm probably supposed to ask you to say your name first.
Okay, then we're fine with that, then. Sorry to take up your time.
Thank you.
Well, thank you for bringing that up. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Is there anyone else here who would like to speak to the dash 2 amendments? Head shaking? Okay. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 811. And what I'm going to do with this, colleagues, is I'm going to ask the proponents and the opponents of this bill to continue working on it and come back to us when they can. I don't have the support in this committee to move it. We only have today and Tuesday. We're past time for amendments. And so that's where we are. I would like the proponents and the opponents to get together, form a work group, keep talking and working, and come back to us when you can, but between now and Tuesday there just isn't enough time on the Senate side. So did I close the public hearing?
I think you did.
Okay. So I'm going to next on our list is open a public hearing on Senate Bill 963.
Would you like me to
Give us an update?
Sure. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'd be happy to. There are two new amendments before you, dash 2s, that are dated April 1509, and dash 3s, that are 36 pages, dated April 22nd, 09. Senate Bill 963, as you remember, revises certain provisions governing homeowners associations in planned communities and in condominiums, and the bill is introduced. You looked at it for the first time on the 7th of April. The dash 2 amendments revise some of the provisions relating to the Board of Directors, and they make some technical revisions, and the dash 2 amendments, as I understand it, resulted from conversations with the real estate agency and proponents, and I'm assuming they will speak to those today, and the dash 3 amendments are a variety of technical changes and some additional significant language that the proponents needed from the bill as introduced. I have one copy of a hand-engrossed version here. It was rather large, so I didn't print 5 of them if you would like to see that. The technical changes in the dash 3s that you have before you are in the first page and about two-thirds, and there are different insertions, etc. And then on page 2 of the dash 3s, where you see on line 18,
That is an additional section that essentially goes at the end of the bill as introduced. That's my understanding. So on page 43, that entire page 3 through 36 is tacked on. Now, the proponents, I believe, will speak to the dash 3s because there are some concerns about how they were drafted and whether they can move forward.
Right. Now, Rich and Barbara, do you want to come up first, or do you want Howard to come up first?
I need to do the fix-it.
Okay.
I'd like to take Barbara and Howard.
Okay, Barbara and Howard, come on up. Welcome.
You go first.
Please. Barbara Kahn, I'm with BioFotheringham, and I'm sort of coordinating a lot of this. And there is, and Lori Skillman from Millicent had pointed that out, we still, I think, in a couple of the technical amendments have an overlap with the dash twos. And I thought we were catching those. But the significant issue on the dash threes is the last section, section 49, and it adds, the intent was to add to ORS 94572, which is the Planned Community Act. It's a large section that, or a long section, I should say, that adds, has a series of statutes that apply to planned communities that were not created under the Planned Community Act, but yet apply to the extent that they're not inconsistent with the documents. And the intent was to add Section 2 and Section 3 of 963, which are new statutes, to that series, so that they could be utilized by previously existing planned communities. However, there was an error in which statutes were inserted, which new sections, and we have two sections of the condominium law being inserted in the Planned Community Act. So that's just, we just couldn't represent that everything was okay, and that's just a drafting error. And there's still a couple overlaps with the dash twos, which we thought we were getting taken care of, but they're not. So that's a technical issue, and they're not difficult to fix, but I'm, at this point, I'm not sure if anything's fixable in the next day or so, but we can help. Howard?
Okay. I'm Howard Feuerstein, Stoll Reeves. I'm on the working group that proposed the statute in addressing Dash 3. As was commented, most of these are just minor wording changes. There are two new sections added to the Act, which basically deal with the common problem we have that when you create a condominium, you have a surveyor who prepares his detailed plat, and you have an attorney that prepares the declaration, which coordinates with the plat. And the current statute has no way to deal with the unfortunate circumstances that sometimes surveyors make mistakes, and sometimes even attorneys make mistakes. And so we have a situation where the surveyor perhaps mismeasured something on the plat, mislocated a parking space on the plat. He needs to fix it. Our statute really doesn't deal with how to fix that, or if the attorney has a typographical error in a square footage or in a mathematical computation. The statute as it currently was written has no way to fix it. And so what these two new sections do is provide a very specific procedure of how to fix errors, not to change things, but how to make things fit what's actually there on the site. And it took a little work for legislative counsel to figure out how to make that work and get that in there so it was quite clear, and procedures were quite clear on how to make those corrections. So that's what these new sections are in Dash 3. Laurie Skillman will talk about the Dash 2, and I want to say that I fully agree with everything in the Dash 2 amendments, and to the extent that this one does not pick up what's in the Dash 2, it really should, because the Dash 2 is correct in the way we would like to see the statute to read. So if you have any questions on this rather confusing presentation, I have to try to answer
any
them.
Any questions?
Can I have a follow-up on that 115?
Any questions? Senators?
No. We don't have any questions. I will need to talk with you about how you'd like to proceed, because
let me have a follow-up comment on,
sure,
because the bill, these amendments are look like there are a lot of new provisions, and one of the statutes, ORS 100-115, deals with plats and amendment plats. It's very, very long, and it has been split out into two parts now. So there's really what is now Section 40. The new Section 43 is what was half of ORS 100-115. But it looks like it's all new, and I just wanted to make it clear that it's not all new provisions. It's
yes.
just splitting it up.
Legislative Council thought that it would be much clearer if we made it two sections. So we've agreed all along, and finally we're getting it done this time, so it'll be easier to read.
Okay. Rich, did you want to add something to that?
Rich Vile, Vile Fotheringham. I just want to suggest to the committee that as I look at the complexity of these things and the fact that we really don't have any disagreement with anyone, mm-hmm. it probably makes the most sense to pass out in its current form. We can fix this on the House side without any problems, and that gives us a little bit more time. I don't think there's anything, there's no traps in here, there's no items that could potentially become points of contention between us and the real estate division, for example. We agree completely. It's exactly. just a matter of working through the language with Legislative Council.
Understood. Thank you. And we do have Lori Skillman here to confirm that. So thank you. Lori, do you want to come up, please? Welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Lori Skillman. I'm a manager with a real estate agency, and I review and approve condominium filings for the state. I worked with several people on the Dash 2 amendments. The Dash 2 amendments are, we cleaned them up so that they were easy to read, corrected some sort of technical changes to it. Basically, the Dash 2 amendments are just about the fact that a member of the board of the directors has to be an individual, but it also allows for if an owner is a limited liability company, for example, then who within the limited liability company could serve on the board as a representative of the company and it, because they're a unit owner. So it kind of cleaned up some of those kinds of issues. I love the language. However, when I started looking at the Dash 3 amendments, there were pieces in here that need to be deleted, and this is the extent of the changes that need to be to Dash 3 to make it conform with the Dash 2 amendments, just sort of deleting some of the language because it was amending some of that same language. So the fixes to make it consistent with the Dash 2s are pretty minimal.
Appreciate that.
I'm
Thank
happy
you.
To answer any other questions.
Ms. Hillman? Thank you. We have one more person signed up. Anne Hannes, please.
Thank you very much. For the record, I'm Ann Hannes with the Association of Oregon Counties, and I apologize. We just saw the Dash 3 amendments, and they're fairly complex amendments. But the main issue that we didn't see in here, we saw where it was deleted in terms of the clerks being able to collect their fees for being able to record the documents, but we didn't see where it was added back in. So we wanted to make sure that you know, the clerks still can be able to do their job with this. So I'm not sure but I just want to raise this as an issue, and if you do have correcting amendments, we'd like the opportunity to be able to review them.
Thank you so much. Any questions? No. Thank you. Anyone else here to testify in the public hearing? I'm going to close the public hearing on 963 and open up a work session on 963, and I'd like to perhaps hear from the proponents about how you would like us to proceed. We can't move this bill today because we don't have the fiscal analysis and paperwork that we need to move it forward, but we would like to get some input from you about whether you would like to, Rich, do you want to come up, and whether you'd like us to send it as is with the or with the Dash 2s. I get the sense that you don't want the Dash 3s in there because Legislative Council would have to include them as drafted, and there is no more time for amendments now because in order to get first we're past the deadline for requesting amendments, and then we need to allow time to get the fiscal analysis on the amendment. So that's just not going to happen by Tuesday, which is our last day to move Senate bills. So we need your input on whether you'd like us to move this. I sense that there's no opposition, and it's a bill that will move forward, but we'd like input from you on how you would like us to do that. And then, Lori, if you could tell us what the legislative fiscal is working on. Are they working on the dash twos?
They're working on both.
They're working on both. Okay.
Both, but we can pull them, Madam Chair. Right, they would be happy if we pulled the
like
threes.
Sounds like the dash threes are problematic, and you wouldn't want those, because they would be engrossed into the bill as is.
Yeah, Chair Bonamici,
problematic.
Members of the committee, my suggestion is that we move it with the dash twos. We all agree that the dash three stuff needs to be fixed, and there's some things that Lori's pointed out that definitely need to be worked out, and that would also give us a chance to address the League of County folks in terms of making sure that fee issue was properly expressed. But we're so confident in terms of the agreement by all parties that we would just as soon move the dash twos and work on it on the House side.
Right, and I saw many nodding heads. Let the record reflect that I saw many nodding heads. Senator Drudge.
Just kind of an alternative. Can't you refer it to Rules, have it cleaned up in Rules, and then send it over? I really am extremely uncomfortable moving something, especially to Consumer Protection on the other side.
Well, it's all technical.
And it's all going to be fixed up, because I've seen things when it's put in the print, it just is, their, you know, agreements fall apart. And so that would be my suggestion.
Madam Chair,
well, we can't move it today because we don't have the fiscal. So I can check and find out, but I would prefer to adopt the Dash 2 amendment now, and then I could look into that. I can't make that decision. It's my understanding that these are technical amendments, not substantive or policy-related.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
The question is, if these are fairly technical questions and there seems to be agreement, is it possible to get the Dash 3s corrected by our meeting on Tuesday?
Mm.
And if we get them corrected, then we get unanimous consent to not to sort of waive the requirement of the fiscal and revenue and send it to the floor.
Oh, that's an idea.
The problem with that, Senator George, is that legislative council has basically said no more amendments.
Mm.
Right. And they said it like, and we mean it.
Yeah.
So
you are a chair, though. You do realize that.
Although that would be ideal, I can ask, but the chances of that happening are extremely slim. So if the committee would prefer to wait, we can do this on Tuesday. We can't move it today anyway because we don't have the required paperwork. If you would like me to inquire into alternatives, I'd be happy to do that, and we can try to find the best way that addresses all the needs and concerns. But it is my understanding that there isn't opposition. There are technical concerns. A lot of it was drafting issues. It wasn't what the proponents put in, and what they got back was a little different from what they requested.
Madam Chair, Senator Girard, we're willing to take the risk that it falls apart on the other side. We understand your point, and I think it's a really good point, but we're willing to take that risk. We're so confident that we really are talking about very technical, non-substantive kinds of tweaks that we'd prefer to get it moved if possible. Thank you.
And it would have to come back over here, as you know, Senator, so...
I sat on the House committee on the other side.
So did I, Senator Girard. All right. Well, I'm going to close the work session then on Senate Bill 963. I think we all have the same goal in mind here, and we will be back on Tuesday to take care of this. So I will now open a public hearing on our final bill today, which is
73, right?
Senate Bill 973. And Lori, can you please give us an update? We had a public hearing on Senate Bill 973 the other day, and we're back to continue that discussion.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, you had Senate Bill 973 before you on Tuesday, the 21st. I'll just briefly summarize this extensive bill having to do with life insurance settlement insurance regulations. It revises the life settlement insurance regulations that are currently in statute. It prohibits a stranger-originated life insurance practices or plans that was commonly referred to as STOLI at the hearing. It requires certain disclosures and prohibits life settlement contracts for 5 years after issuance of the policy unless certain exemptions apply. It requires an annual statement from the provider, life settlement providers, when they settle policies within the 5 years. It specifies some of those items to be included in that statement. It prohibits certain solicitations by brokers, providers, producers, or insurance companies. It adds regulations on advertising of those contracts. It makes the violation of life settlement contracts an unlawful trade practice, and it repeals certain provisions of the current act, and it has extensive new definitions of the relevant terms.
Thank you very much. Excellent summary. I'm going to start with Rick Bennett because he's the only person signed up who hasn't already spoken on this. So, Rick, you want to come on up? Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Rick Bennett, Director of Government Relations, AARP Oregon. It brought to my attention that my absence on Tuesday was in fact noticed, and so I wanted to be here today to offer very brief comments in support of the bill. Our public policy does in fact support regulation of these life settlement products. The regulation should include licensing requirements, record retention, and strong disclosure requirements. The analysis by our national policy staff indicates that, in fact, the disclosure requirements are quite good, and the licensure as well. And with that, we offer our support to the bill.
Thank you so much. We did miss you on Tuesday. Any questions for Rick? Senator George.
I missed most of the hearing also. So, but I want to ask you, I did talk to the opponents after the hearing via phone because I want to get both sides of the issue, and there was a number of really interesting issues brought up about the fact that perhaps in some situations the holder of the life insurance doesn't get the best price possible for the cash value of that, and it seems like to me there's a legitimate issue there that exists kind of in this window, and I was just, this bill has come up so quickly and I'm trying to understand it. Would you take a look at that and see if you think that there's some validity in that to kind of give me some advice? Because I really do believe that there is a potential for consumers actually being hurt unintentionally on the backside of this if we eliminate some of the competition to life insurance companies when it comes to cash value.
Madam Chair, Senator George, I've almost at this point provided you with the vast knowledge I have on this particular issue. I will make contact with our staff who actually has some understanding of these settlement products and ask them that question, but
okay.
I don't have anything to offer here this time.
That's fine.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rick. Next, I'll have John Mangan come up, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Again, for the record, my name is John Mangan, and I'm Regional Vice President for the American Council of Life Insurers. And I appreciated the opportunity on Tuesday to talk at some length, some exhausting length perhaps, and hopefully I didn't confuse you too much. But I'm back to try to answer any questions. I know there have been questions that have come up. I tried to respond to some of the issues that came up in testimony that there were interesting confusion about, and I did provide that to each of you, and hopefully that helped. I'm happy to walk through any of those in more detail if you like, and I'm happy to answer Senator George's question if you'd like. And I would just reiterate that one of the key provisions in this bill is that five-year waiting period. It's not a ban. It's a waiting period, carefully crafted, and I have provided and actually meant to provide to your administrator a summary on that issue. And that summary essentially just describes what the provision does and doesn't do, because I think there is a little confusion about it. It's a very, very narrow waiting period, and it only applies if there are three things in place with this transaction. The three things are the use of potentially fraudulent types of indicators. And the first and most important of these is the existence, in fact, of what's really a predatory loan. And this loan is a loan that never has to be repaid. This loan is a loan as described in the bill and the regulators who drafted it, as a loan that's made to a policy owner that has no loan payments and is not meant to be repaid ever. And the loan is simply provided so that, in essence, the stranger can provide the premium to buy the policy at a certain later date, and the premium comes through a loan vehicle so that it's masked and that it doesn't look like a STOLI on its surface. If one of those loans is in place and the policy owner is not paying any part of the cost from their own pocket, then that's indicator number one that would trigger the five-year wait. Indicator number two that would have to be in place would be that at the time of the application, a person has taken a life expectancy evaluation not submitted by the life insurance company, but by an investor or outside party. And that evaluation would take place before the application for actual insurance to determine what the lifespan is of that person in case they settle the policy. Now, if they're already thinking and talking and having an evaluation about settling the policy before the policy is issued, then that would indicate an intent to settle at the time of application, which under Oregon's insurable interest law would be a violation. So that's the second trigger of the five-year waiting period. The third trigger is another piece, which would be an evaluation of the amount you might get if you settled. And again, this evaluation would take place at or before the application. And it would say to the person, the senior that's being approached, this is only related to seniors usually, it would say, if you settle this, now that we've done your evaluation, if you settle it with us in a couple years after the fraud period expires in 2 years, this is approximately how much we might give you. Now that indicates again that there's a plan or some kind of intent to settle this policy at the instant the person's buying it. Again, if that's true, that would violate Oregon's insurable interest statute, which is in ORS 743, by the way. So when those three indicators are together, then you have a waiting period of 5 years before you can actually sell it to the investors. If you wait those 5 years, even if those indicators are in place, you can sell it after 5 years. So what's important to note is that if a person pays any part of the premium for their policy, the five-year waiting period doesn't apply. If these three indicators are not in place, the five-year waiting period does not apply. If there is no life expectancy evaluation performed at that moment of application, the five-year waiting period does not apply. And if there's no evaluation of a future settlement, the five-year waiting period does not apply. And of course, there's no five-year waiting period or any waiting period for someone who's subject to one of the exceptions that's on page 17, and those of the bill, 973. Those exceptions include, and I think it would be important to look at these because a lot of questions have come up. Are we really restricting people from settling? This would be the conversion of a policy from a group plan. If you did that, you'd get credit for the 5 years or whatever years you had under that group plan. If you retire, that would count. You could settle your policy without any waiting period. If you're terminally or chronically ill, if your spouse dies, if you become divorced, again, if you retire, if you become physically disabled, or if you have a bankruptcy, you can settle in all of those cases without any waiting period. So I wanted to make sure you knew that restriction is extremely narrow. It's only triggered when you have the three indicators of a STOLI fraud. And I gave you at the last hearing a copy of this fraudulent case in Minnesota. $127 million of insurance on one person. And this wasn't Warren Buffett. This was just a guy in Minnesota. The broker in that case has been charged, and he's probably going to prison. However, the $127 million was issued, and these indicators were in place, and our companies are on the hook and will ultimately probably pay those benefits. And that money is going to have to come from somewhere, and it's going to come from higher prices, and seniors are going to pay more because of that. So that sort of gives you a sense of how important this five-year provision is, how narrow it is, and what it's meant to stop. Ultimately, if you had this bill, 973, in Minnesota, it would have been basically a warning sign. It would say, you could do those deals. You could do the fraudulent deal, but you're going to have to wait 5 years to get your asset. And I will tell you, since the money behind this is coming from Wall Street hedge funds, foreign hedge funds, companies that are now either defunct that you may know, like Bear Stearns and Lehman Brothers, or others that are owned by the federal government at this point, They aren't willing to wait 5 years and pay the premiums to get their asset. They want their asset delivered in 2 years. So that's kind of where we're coming from and where the regulators were coming from when they crafted that provision. I'm happy to answer any other questions.
Madam Chair.
Senator Burdick.
Just to be devil's advocate, maybe I have a criminal mind, but you have, if the senior pays all or any part of the premium, there's no 5-year waiting period. Why couldn't these investors just put the senior on a nickel a month, you know, $10 a year payment plan through their bank and forget about it? I mean, I don't see this as a particularly effective bar.
Madam Chair and Senator Burdick, I'm sure I oversimplified that piece there, but what it says is that the language in the actual bill on page 17, it's in section, page 16 and 17, the definition of this premium loan is so specific, and what it means is that it's a loan that where the person has no skin in the game, where they have no part of their income is going into it, and where it's set up as not coming from any of their funds. And so, in essence, if they're paying part of it, if they're paying half of it and maybe borrowing some to pay the premium, then that's probably legitimate. Because the only kind that the regulators focused on was the type that the 100% of it is coming from a third party, not even from their family or their business or anything else. It's coming from a third party.
Well, then, Madam Chair, why don't you have it worded, instead of the seniors not paying any or part of the premium, why don't you turn it around and say if a third party is paying any or part of the premium? To me, that would be a tighter protection, because it seems to me there are ways to meet that bar without, you know, there are ways to get money for the premium from the seniors' funds.
Sure.
Pretty easily, frankly, with today's electronic withdrawal devices, I would be much more comfortable to see, you know, if a third party is paying any or all of the premium.
Madam Chair and Senator, I understand your concern, and I would just perhaps encourage you to take a look at the definition, which is on page 17, beginning at line 21,
okay.
And it is so specific, and I think it does cover your concern. You're right that we think, in fact, no matter what bill you pass, if you decide to pass a bill, the speculators can find a way around some of these things. This happens to be extremely tight and extremely narrow, and we think it does the job. But, yes, you can still game the system at some point, probably.
And you know, along those lines, to follow up, Madam Chair, you said if any of these things are lacking, there's no 5-year waiting period. And I'm just wondering if that could be tightened up, if, you know, if you have, unless all of these things, I don't know. I mean, these are people who are basically trafficking in death, and I just don't really think that they're going to be held back by some of these requirements.
Madam Chair and Senator Burdick, we appreciate that comment. I would point you to, and again, this is a big bill, I realize it, in section 14, line 43, there really is a statement there that kind of goes to that point.
Which page?
Page 16 of the bill.
Page 16?
16, at the bottom, section 14, line 43. And it says, this 5-year restriction does not apply if the owner certifies to the life settlement provider that any one or more of the following conditions has been met within the 5-year period. And then it lists all the exceptions, the retirement, the conversion, the disability, the non-existence of any of those features I just mentioned that indicate fraud. So I think it's fairly clear, but again, that's because I read this bill 3 times a day.
I have a question that sort of follow up on something that was said about by Senator Burdick about the language, if a third party is paying. What if, for example, somebody's working for a company and the company is paying his or her insurance premiums? Does that mean that the consumer or the senior wouldn't be somebody retired? Somebody's working for a company and the company is making that payment. Does that mean that the person is not making the payment?
Madam Chair, no, it doesn't. And there are many instances where an employer, whether public or private or small business, will pay the entire premium for life insurance for their employees. The key is there, the life insurance is on the employee, and the benefits are for their family and their beneficiaries. So there is no third party in the mix. The benefit is for the employee and for their relatives. In addition, employers sometimes buy insurance for business purposes. And the employer, under common law, has a long-established insurable interest. Other than family members and loved ones, employers also have an insurable interest. It's limited. It's limited to the benefit of their own employees, for instance. So they could buy insurance on a key person. Small firms do that all the time. Law firms do it on partners because that firm has a established insurable interest in that partner or key employee, can buy insurance on them, and that benefit comes back to the firm to save it from potentially going out of business. So, but that's established under common law, and it's decades and decades of common law. So, but it's very narrow.
Thank you. And then also there was an example that was discussed at the hearing on Tuesday. We were missing a couple of committee members, so for those of you who have already heard this, I just want some clarification, please, for the record. There was an example about the father with the insurance policy, and his son is starting a business, and the father would like to cash in on the policy to help the son with the business. Would this be an issue under this bill if that happened in the first couple of years?
Madam Chair, absolutely not. It wouldn't change anything about a person's current rights and the availability of cash in any cash value policy that's currently in force or sold in the future. Because a person who buys a cash value life insurance policy, it is their asset. They own it. If they bought it with their own money, they own it. Obviously, this bill deals with policies that are bought with someone else's money. But if you buy it, you own it, and it has cash value that actually accumulates over time. So in the first few years, the cash value is fairly low. You have the death benefit, but the cash value is still growing. But at any time in that period, you can borrow from it. You can surrender it, cash it out, take the money. Most people who have a cash value policy for a number of years access their cash value through a loan, as I've done many times, to use as a down payment or to buy a car, to pay for a student loan. And that's an unlimited right. So this bill doesn't even affect that.
And then I have another question, too. We had the discussion about the National Council of Life Insurers model and then what was called the NCOIL model. And will you clarify, 973 is, my understanding, is a hybrid, that it's sort of the best of both, I guess. If it's not one or the other, it's a combination. Is that correct?
Yes, Madam Chair. It's essentially the entire NAIC model that was approved without dissent by the National Insurance Commissioners. Plus, it includes the key protections of the NCOIL model, and those include a definition, an actual definition of STOLE, which is in Section 2 of the bill. And that defines, Senator Burdick, some of these deals that are clearly somebody bought insurance on somebody that was not right. Like the two ladies in Los Angeles that got the homeless person to sign a form. They bought $1 million of coverage on the homeless person and ran him over in a car. That's clearly STOLE, and that's defined in Section 2.
Which in this case is the least of their problems, I imagine.
Exactly. Section 15 includes the key prohibition on doing those kinds of things. So there was some confusion about whether that's in here, but it's definitely in here.
Thank you.
Are there other questions?
Madam Chair. I guess what concerns me about this bill is it came out so late and it's very complex. Obviously, I think there's sort of agreement that STOLEs need to be regulated, and there seem to be some legitimate concerns from the opponents of this particular piece of legislation. And it seems like everybody wants to regulate it, and I think that there's clear reason why we would. But how is it that we haven't kind of come up with some kind of consensus between what the opponents are asking for and this bill, which just came out the other day and is a lot of pages of technical things for me to understand? So how do we not have sort of a compromise here?
Madam Chair and Senator George, I mean, it's a tremendously good question. And I will tell you that having dealt with this now for over 4 years in the debate at the regulator level, the debate at NCOIL, and the debate in each and every state, there's a sense that this looks a bit like a turf battle between two industries. But I will tell you that our turf, anyway, is the million people in Oregon that own life insurance for the right reason, and the reason that's sanctioned under law, which is to have an insurable interest. And the other side is come up with some innovative ideas about how to sell a life insurance policy you no longer want after it's been in effect for a while. And that's all fine and good. Our companies do not object to that. But this middle turf is the area where we're trying to define transactions that are perhaps masked, that look maybe like they're legitimate. There's a trust in someone's name, or there's a loan that looks like it could be legitimate, and it's not. In fact, behind it, and proven behind it, is an intent to buy the policy by third-party investors and transfer it. And so we do disagree strongly about what's happening in that middle ground.
Follow up, Madam Chair. Understand, we're in consumer protection. So if there's a turf battle going on, we've got to recognize this turf battle. But we've got to figure out what's best for the consumer. And from my perspective, I've typically been a very strong supporter of the insurance industry because I understand the importance of the industry to all the businesses. However, I like to have sort of a conflict situation, almost, because it keeps people honest. And to me, what this other industry does is keeps the insurance industry honest of not shortchanging me on a cash value. Because if you put in enough regulations on the other industry, then the insurance industry could then go to the consumer and say, hey, we're going to give you a nickel on the dollar because nobody else can buy it. And so, to me, the turf battle is very important because it keeps both sides honest. What we're trying to do here, it seems to me, is get rid of the purely fraudulent transactions. So I'm trying to make sure in this very complex bill that we've got a turf battle going on that I actually think is healthy, and what we want to do is eliminate the fraud. And I'm not sure I'm comfortable that we've gotten there with this bill.
Senator Bonamici and Senator George, it's an excellent point, and I totally agree with you. And I think it's important to look at, in the middle of this turf battle is the key component, the key constituent that we all have, which are seniors, and they're the ones this battle's being waged on. And I think if you look at that and you consider that carefully, that the life settlement in the transaction is aimed at someone, not at a 40-year-old, not at a 50-year-old, but at people that are 70, 75, and 80 years old. They're in the middle of this little turf thing. And those are the only contracts that are really available to the life settlement company to buy because those folks have a fairly short lifespan. You wouldn't buy a policy on me because I'm going to live, hopefully, beyond this hearing, 10 or 20 years. And that's too much, too many premiums to pay. And then the other piece, Senator, is how much is the person getting, that 75 or 80-year-old, when they're made this pitch? Now, we heard testimony the other day that the average that person might get is 3 or 4 times what the cash value is. But what they didn't say is how old the policy was, because we don't know anything about their business statistics. We don't know if that's a 1-year-old policy, a 2-year-old policy, a 3-year-old policy. Probably is. It has low cash value. And they didn't mention that even though they may be offering 3 times that low cash value, they're only on average, at least today, according to their own analysis, offering 5 to 8 cents on the dollar for the death benefit to the senior. So what that means is, yes, they're buying a $1 million contract, and maybe they're giving them $50,000, which is more than the cash value currently, but the policy is worth $1 million, so that's 5%. The other $950,000 is going to the brokers who promote it and to the ultimate investors who are Wall Street hedge funds and others, you know, who don't live in Oregon. So that's the key issue that we have, is that the battle's being waged on the back of people who are 70 to 80 years old.
Follow-up, Madam Chair. Sure. With all due respect to this reference to Wall Street hedge funds, Wall Street hedge funds own a ton of insurance companies.
Yeah.
The fraud I've heard about when it comes to seniors, with all due respect to the industry, is insurance agents who are going out and predatorily looking for elderly people to sell way over insurance to take in tons of excessive premium payments. So if what I've heard generally over the years has been that the bad players are in insurance companies who are predatorily seeking out seniors to try to sell them inappropriate life insurance or annuity products that don't match what the senior wants. Now the insurance industry comes in and says, oh, there's these bad players out there who are buying our product from these seniors at a higher price than we're willing to pay, and you understand my reluctance to sort of accept what's being done, mm-hmm. meaning you're willing to pay them a cash price for an insurance policy. This other company is willing to pay them more. Maybe it is only 8 cents, but you guys are offering them 3 cents on the dollar. And you're going to say, come in and say, well, that industry are the bad players. And I'm having a real hard time with that. And I guess what I'm trying to say is I may agree with you at some point, but this is a complex bill and a complex issue, and I'm not sure I'm safe saying to the insurance companies, let's get rid of these guys because they're the bad players. I think there's a lot of fraud going on here, and I'd like to clear it up, but
yeah.
I'm really uncomfortable with the speed of this particular piece of legislation, I guess, Madam Chair.
Senator, I would just say to that we couldn't agree more in terms of any company or any agent that is doing what you just described. And, of course, the difference is our industry is fully regulated and fully transparent, and we're accountable to the commissioner and accountable to the insurance code. So if that goes on, we definitely are accountable for that. And of course, this bill addresses some of the compensation issues. It addresses things that you're talking about that relate to agents and brokers who may, in fact, be the instigator for many of these activities.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Sure. And just as a reminder, we did talk about this a little bit on Tuesday, some of the pitfalls for the consumer, for the seniors who are entering into these is when they're given the funds to purchase the policy, they're generally not told that that's taxable income. And so they have a tax consequence. And then also if they want to go get a policy to protect their own family, they find that they're already insured to the level beyond which they can get more insurance. So that's problematic as well. So we also want to hear from Dave Fiscom, unless there's any other questions for John. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. Good day, members. Senator Burdick and Rosenbaum, it's nice to see you again this afternoon. Second committee together. For the record, I am Dave Fiscom. I'm here representing Coventry, a leader in the secondary market for insurance. And obviously, I'll be at a bit of a deficit today because my colleague who joined me Tuesday for your hearing, Robert Woolley, the former insurance commissioner from Louisiana, who was back in Louisiana, I think, isn't here today to respond to my friend John Mank and his comments. I wasn't even sure if it was necessary for me to testify today in light of the testimony we did provide on Tuesday. I did want to do, however, one thing for the record, which is provide the document I have provided you in response to Senator Garrod's question relative to the summary of state activity on NAIC and NCOIL model settlement acts around the country. My request, Coventry prepared the document for you, which I've provided to you. I did give that to you yesterday in your offices, and I won't read the information there to you, believing you can do that yourself. What I would say for the record is that our position is not whether there should be regulation, especially of the bad actors, the folks who engage in STOLI. The question is how to regulate. We think there is a better approach than that embodied in Senate Bill 973. I have asked Coventry to prepare a red line of 973 to indicate where they would suggest that amendments might be necessary from their vantage point to make sure that this is a regulatory approach which is not one-sided, which is in fact a consensus product, and I believe that is possible. Coventry has been involved around the country in a number of other enterprises such as this. The legislation is obviously very familiar to them. When they first saw this, they said, oh yeah, that's the hybrid bill, and there are bills like this that go around the country, and the company I represent tries to participate in them. I know in the testimony you heard Tuesday, there's issues about the five-year ban versus the two-year time frame, which is our preference related to the contestability of life insurance products as they're sold. There are also some issues related to advertising that we have described in our testimony Tuesday as well as around the country. I would refer you not to this moment but to page 4 of the testimony you got from us on Tuesday, which describes the NCOIL model and the protections built into that relative to both the STOLI problem as well as consumer property rights. I received today from Mr. Mangan, he testified, the copy of his one-page handout to you, and we'll provide that by fax to my client and have their comments on that to you for tomorrow. So I don't want to go into any more detail on that right now. I guess I would suggest to you that I hope there's a way for us within the confines of this legislative process to find common ground to reach agreement, because I think we share the objective of regulating the bad actors for the benefit of consumers, especially senior citizens. We have no problem with that. We want to participate in that process, whether it's Madam Chair in your committee or in another Senate committee or in the House of Representatives or in a work group that's formed. We want to participate in that to produce a better bill than the one before you, and we pledge to do that. So with that, I'll stop. Thank you.
Questions? I'm not going to let him off without any questions.
I actually have one.
Okay, thank you.
I don't have any questions.
Dave, I appreciate it. I did get to talk to your client on the phone outside the hearing. I apologize, I wasn't here to hear the testimony. If the other model, the Incoli model,
yes,
is your client supportive of those regulations of the STOLE through that model versus the one that we have here?
Madam Chair, Senator George, I think the best way for me to answer that question is we prefer that to be the starting point, and then we prefer to sit down with the other side, so to speak, wherever that is. We've done that with Mr. Mangan, and not me, but others of my client in the state of Washington, the state of California, and elsewhere, and then draft a model, an act for that's aligned with the law in a state, Oregon in this case, that starts with NCOIL and that doesn't reject totally NAIC, but we tend to start with the NCOIL model, and our testimony, starting on page 4, addresses that we believe the NCOIL model of starting point addresses STOLE and protects consumers' property rights. That's where we start as opposed to the bill before you. But we don't finish there necessarily, because I think what we benefit from, and as I've heard the process described to me in the week and a half I've represented Coventry, is genuinely give and take process. When we sit across the table, perhaps with legislative leadership, such as yourselves or others who are able to force competing interests to hammer out an agreement, and we're prepared to do that here in whatever venue you suggest to us.
Did your client support the Washington legislation?
Pardon me?
Did your client support the Washington legislation?
Madam Chair, I believe the answer to that question is yes. I've been told that we supported the Coventry supported the Washington language, and that was told to me on the day last week, I believe, when the governor signed it.
Any other
but
questions?
I wasn't involved in the state of Washington, so I can't speak from personal knowledge, obviously.
Thank you. Well, anyone else here to say a few words about the Senate bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome. Come on up, Todd.
Madam Chair and committee members, Todd Thacker with Prudential Financial. I just wanted to raise 2 points. Number one, Prudential supports the NCOIL model, but we don't support the California bill because what's happened is the NCOIL model is so watered down that we believe it doesn't stop the fraud cases that you've heard about. And number two, Senator George, with regard to this bill and stopping legitimate impacting the life settlement business, we really don't believe that it does. And the reality is it's tried to be so narrowly drawn that it only gets at those settlements that would have all those indicia of the fraud. And then even then, after 5 years, those could be settled. So we really believe that anybody, you know, and I think the various examples that you could come up with someone wanting to settle a policy, they can still settle the policy. We're not, as I said in my testimony the other day, we're not here to stop life settlements. What we're here to, and we believe this bill does, is it stops the wager on human lives that comes when someone sells or is willing to sell or doesn't even realize that their insurable interest is being sold. And that's the difference. Anytime a policy is bought for a legitimate purpose, you know, those things are out there and can be settled, and we believe with this bill they can still be settled. So.
Any questions? Thank you. Thank you for your testimony.
Sure, thank you.
And I did want to let the committee know that I received something from Nationwide Financial in support, and they said that the It's important to point out that this, I guess I should back up. I'll get you a copy of this, but they say the five-year moratorium is the foundation of this legislation and that it economically discourages those who are preying on senior citizens. It is important to point out that this feature will not affect legitimate life insurance policy settlement transactions. So that's from Nationwide, and I'll ask Lori to get a copy of that to the committee. Anyone else here to testify about Senate Bill 973? We have one more go at this on Tuesday, and that's it. So I encourage you to think about it and get in touch with, I know, Mr. Fiscom and probably Mr. Mangan will be in the building tomorrow and Monday, so if you have any questions. And we'll revisit this on Tuesday. With that, I'll close the public hearing and adjourn the committee for today. Oh, thank you.